All right. So, here we go. Book of Romans. Now, I'm so excited. I get to teach Romans 3 tonight and Romans 4. Oh, man, the best stuff ever. What a blessing. All right, by the way, it says, West Coast School of Ministry, I'm teaching a class in Romans here at UC Merced. I should put that up there, but I'm also teaching a class for a school of ministry this Saturday through sometime in June. Same material, pretty much. Okay. All right. So, dual themes in Romans. Anybody? Yeah. Two themes in Romans. Scholars debate which is the principal one. I have an opinion on that. Two themes in Romans. Righteousness comes from God. Righteousness comes from God. Not as close. Yes. Right, we are righteous by faith. Salvation by faith, yes, but more specifically, righteousness comes from faith. Okay, good. And what is the other theme? Ah, God is saving Jew and Gentile alike. Okay, got it? So, righteousness or salvation is by faith. Sub-theme, in Christ, both Jew and Gentile are one, are saved together. Theme passage, let's read it. Romans 1:17. Romans 1:17. Here it is. For in the gospel, a righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. And a little bit more literal in Greek is that this is a righteousness that is from faith to faith. In other words, it begins with faith and it ends with faith. It's all about faith. So therefore, our righteousness is about faith. Okay, that's it. That's what Martin Luther discovered, and that's the starting gun for the Reformation. But what the Reformation doctors, if you will, didn't notice is that there's this other theme that because you can't really explain Romans 9 through 11 as talking about righteousness by faith. And so the one theme that actually covers the entire book beginning to end is this thing about the fact that salvation is first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. And really the culminating statement about that is going to be in Romans 3:9 and Romans 3:20, so we're going to get there in a second. Okay, got it? All right, I'm going to skip most of the material, but I want to look at our outline. All right, blah, 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 debate. Okay, good. So Romans 1:1-17, the righteousness of God. And then Romans 1:18-216, basically, or 1:18-1, depending on how you slice it. The Gentiles are toast. They are lost. They're so lost. All right. And at the end of that, of course, the Jews are going, yeah, I mean, those Gentiles, man, they're messed up. They're so bad. Right. And then, Romans 2:17-229, or arguably 2:1-229, the Jews are equally lost. And he says, you guys are as sinful as the Gentiles. Right. Was that literally true? Not really, but they're equal. Well, we'll see. He's going to summarize it in Romans 3. He's going to talk about that. And then Romans 3:1-20, all are lost. And then Romans 3:21-5:21, salvation is by faith through the blood of Jesus. And then the rest of the book, but we're going to get to that later. So let's go to Romans 3. Okay, very good. Page 12 of my notes. Here we go. Great. So, part 4. So, part 1, the righteousness of God. Part 2, the Gentiles are totally lost. Part 3, well, guess what? The Jews are equally lost. And if the Gentiles are lost and the Jews are lost, who's left?
No one.
No one. So, he's going to summarize that in Romans 3:1-20. All are lost. Now, let me read first Romans 3:1-4. What advantage there What advantage then is there in being a Jew? Now, here's the thing. At the end of chapter 2, the Jews are like, this is depressing. I mean, why even bother being a Jew? I mean, what's the advantage? I mean, if we're equally lost, in fact, basically what he says in chapter 2 is, if you know the law, then you're more lost than if you didn't know the law. He says to the Jews, you're even more lost than these other people. So the Jews are wringing their hair. They're feeling depressed. Didn't God say, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated? I mean, what's this all about? And so 3 times in the book of Romans, Paul stops what he's doing. He says, no. It's so much better being a Jew. And then he takes it right back, right after that. And interesting, we'll see that. So let's read 1-4. What advantage then is there in being a Jew? Remember, this is a diatribe. The book of Romans is a diatribe. So he's having this sort of staged debate. And so somebody is saying to him in this staged debate, what advantage is there? So often Paul will stop. He'll ask the question that his pretend opponent would be asking. That's what he's doing here. What advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value is there in circumcision? Much in every way. First of all, the Jews have been entrusted with the very words of God. What if some were unfaithful? Will their unfaithfulness nullify God's faithfulness? Not at all. Let God be true and every human being a liar, as it is written, so that we may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. So he says to the Jews, and he'll say, even more so in Romans 9, several verses, like 1-6, he's going to say, theirs is the kingdom, theirs is the scriptures, theirs are the prophets, and all this sort of stuff. Saying, no, it's much, much better to have been a Jew. There's a great advantage in being a Jew. I mean, you were given the very words of God. Which would be better, to be entrusted with the keys to the kingdom or to be left out in the cold? But the problem is that most of the Jews did not combine that gift with faith. And without faith, it's not going to do them any good. So he says, let God be true and every man a liar. In Romans 9:20, he's going to say, who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Basically saying, if you got a problem with me, you didn't mind when I did good stuff for you. No. I chose you. I gave you the prophets. I gave you the scriptures. I gave you a king. You were happy about that when I chose you and those guys were on the outs. So now I'm trying to bring the Gentiles in and you don't like it. I mean, you can't have it both ways, basically. All right, 5-8. And again, here's more of this, in quotes, diatribe. But if our righteousness brings out God's righteousness, again, this is the enemy saying this, and he's quoting them, and he's going to respond to that. Got it? But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? I'm using a human argument. Certainly not. Oh, several times in the book of Romans, Paul will say, no way, that's ridiculous. Every time he does it, it's because he's responding to his opponent. This is this diatribe. So he's basically throwing out the idea that he heard the enemy saying about him, and then he says, that's ridiculous. Certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not say, as some slanderously claim, Paul says, let us do evil that good may result. Their condemnation is deserved. So it's part of the diatribe. It's kind of like Romans 6:1, as we'll see. Shall we sin that grace might increase? No way! Ridiculous! What a crazy thought that is. So apparently, some of his opponents have been accusing him of this big fancy word, antinomianism. All right? Antinomianism. And I don't like to use too many big words, but if you ever use a big word, you gotta explain it, you gotta define it, and then it's okay to use it, okay? So an antinomian, I looked it up in Wikipedia, which is the the authority on all definitions. Everybody knows. Related to the view that Christians are released from by grace from the obligation to observing the moral law. So an antinomian and one who says, hey, we got grace. Let's go for it, man. Let's take advantage. And so Paul is being accused by his opponents, these sort of legalistic Judaizers who want to kind of bring in some of the law and obedience to law as part of salvation. He's being accused of being an antinomian. And that is generally a person who rejects all social morality, but in the Christian context, one who rejects the requirement to observe the moral law. You can do whatever you want because we've got grace. So let our sins increase. Wow. All right. So there's three lies that he's opposing. One, if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness, or if our lies make God look even more truthful, why not say, hey, let's do evil that good may result? And Paul says, ridiculous, stupid, crazy. All right, now Romans 3, 9 through 20. Here's a key point in the entire book of Romans. Let's read Romans 3, 9 all the way through 18. What shall we conclude then? So here we go. We've been through two chapters plus eight verses. And he's concluding all the introductory stuff. Okay, got it? What shall we say, conclude then? Do we have any advantage? Who's we? The Jews. Now, here's the thing. What did he just say about whether the Jews have an advantage about eight verses ago? Absolutely. And guess what he's about to say? No, not at all. All right? Confusing, right? I have to explain that. He is not contradicting himself, but it sure seems that way. All right, let's read that again. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? The answer is yes and no. Okay? The answer is not at all. Not at all. Now, I'm going to come back. I'm going to explain why this actually makes sense. Okay? For we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. How many of you are tempted to feel a little defensive right now? How many of you are being honest with me right now? Come on. Nothing? I've never done anything good? Oh, Paul, you're going crazy on us right now. Your throats are open graves, he says. Your tongues practice deceit. You don't lie. You don't just lie. You figure out more and better and greater ways to lie. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways, and the ways of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, you got to understand what Paul's doing is he's quoting the Old Testament.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing. And he does this in Romans a lot. He's constantly saying, as the scripture says, as the prophets have said. And so the thing is, who's he going after? The Jews, right? He's quoting their Bible and saying, in case you didn't get it, this is exactly what it says. He's quoting from several different scriptures. I might have the list there. Is it in the thing? Oh, okay. It's in my notes. All right. Anyway, he's got quoting from a bunch of verses. Yeah. Psalm 51, 4, Psalm 14, 1, Psalm 5, 9, Psalm 140, verse 3, Psalm 10, 7, etc. A bunch of them. And Isaiah, by the way. All right. Now, who is we? In this scripture, it's the Jews. Or how about this? We is the Jews or anybody else who thinks their righteousness is based on how good they are. So, yeah, quiet. All right. All right. Now it says here, why? Because of verse 9. Okay. I'm not going to answer it. I promise. I'm not going to answer it, but all right. Ooh, it's Kai Foster. I'm sorry. He's an important person. But sorry about that, folks. That's pretty bad. All right. Okay, so he says, there is no difference. Now, really what I'd say is there's no essential difference. Because there is a difference. Didn't he just say, like, 9 verses ago? So, what's the advantage of being a Jew? He says, much in many ways, and he's going to list it. All right? So, but the point is this. Jew and Gentile are under sin. All right?
Yeah.
And therefore, they're the same in that sense. So anyway, as I'm reading Romans 3, I'm starting to feel a little bit defensive. You're telling me I've not done a single good thing? Wow. Ever?
Wow.
That's not what he's saying. Not exactly. He's not saying no one has ever done a good thing. He's saying that nobody has ever done good. Right? He's not saying nobody's ever done a good thing. What he's saying is that nobody has done good. What did he say to the rich young ruler? No one is good except God alone. So you're going to stand before the throne of God on Judgment Day and say, I was good? Are you going to do that? I remember one time a friend of mine was a home healthcare person for this atheist guy who was dying. He said, could you come over and get with him? Sure, yeah, I'll talk to him. Yeah, you know, I'll give it a shot. And I sat down talking with him. He said, you know what? I am the best person I've ever known. I'm the best person I've ever known. And he believed it. And when he started telling stories about his life, I was hard to argue. Really, this guy, he was just a great guy. But the problem is, he's still a sinner. All right? So, you know, and he says, no one does good at all. You know, I'm still feeling defensive. No one sees God. Now wait a minute. In Jeremiah 29, 11 through 12, it says, those who seek God with all their heart. You know, what's he talking about? Bottom line, here's the thing. Are you a good person? No, you're not. Have you ever done good? Yes, but that's not the point. Before God, are you a good person? And outside of Jesus, the answer is no. Is Romans 3, 13 through 18 true of you? The answer is, technically, maybe not all of it. All right? And probably the Jews in his audience are really, really struggling right now. There's like 6 things on that list I never really actually did. But remember, he says there is no difference, right? There is no difference. And the point is there's no, see that yellow up there? There's no essential difference. There's no essential difference. All right? And so basically then, yes, because they're part of the covenant, the Jews as a whole have an advantage. But individually, before God on Judgment Day, they have literally no advantage at all. In other words, if they take advantage of what they had, you know, in the law of Moses, great. All right? And so, yes, there's an advantage, sort of like in salvation history, the Jews have an advantage. So Jews and Gentiles are alike under sin, as one commentator I was reading last week said, this is a statement not about salvation history, but about salvation. In the story of salvation history, in the story of how God has worked with human beings over time in history, the Jews have a big advantage. But in terms of salvation, which is all that really matters in the end, right? No advantage. That's his conclusion. Jew and Gentile alike are under sin. So he's going to summarize here in verse 19 and 20. All right? No one seeks God. Now, wait a minute. What about Jeremiah 29:11-12 says, you seek God with all your heart and blah, blah, blah. Paul, you're exaggerating. Here's the question, though. Can you, before God, say, I'm a good person? Jesus says, no one is good but God alone. And it's true. It's true. All right, so let's summarize. By the way, we're going to start the good news. Romans 1:1-17, introduction. But Romans 1:18 through chapter 3:20, bad news, man. This is depressing stuff. No one is good. No one is righteous. All seek, they invent ways of doing evil. All of us, we're terrible people. Wow. Thanks a lot, Paul. But guess what? It's true. Well, there's hope. That's true. That starts in Romans 3:21. So let's summarize in Romans 3:19 and 20. Here we go. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by the works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. The purpose of the law, then, was to make us aware of how sinful we are. That's what it did. It made us realize how truly sinful we are and how much we need the grace of God. It made sin truly and utterly sinful. All right? In Romans 7:13, let's turn to Romans 7:13. All right, we're going to be there in a couple weeks again anyway, but let's go over there. All right, Romans 7:13, did that which is good then become death to me? By no means. Nevertheless, in order that sin might be recognized as sin, it used what is good, the law of Moses, to bring about my death, so that through the commandment, sin might become utterly sinful. All right, and that's kind of depressing, you know, to think about all this great stuff with Moses and the prophets and David and all that kind of stuff. All right, what was the purpose of it? So that sin might be recognized as sin. He used what is good, the law of Moses, to bring about my death. So what did Paul gain from being a Jew? Death. But guess what? He would have had it anyway if he was a Gentile, but at least as a Jew, he knew a bunch of stuff that kind of helped him out when he became a Christian, so it's not so bad. And he's going to get back to that, okay? Romans 5:20. Sort of similar. The law was brought in so that trespass might increase. Now, Paul has a way of saying stuff kind of to get you in your face a little bit. He's saying the purpose of the law was that people would sin more. No, the purpose of the law was so that people would realize how sinful they truly are. Okay, got it? And all those sacrifices, you know, on the Day of Atonement in Jerusalem, the Kidron Brook literally ran red with all the blood flowing down. And then they come back next year. They do it again. They come back next year. They do it again. They come back next year. Do it again. There's something to be learned from all this. All right? So, moving on. Now we're going to go to the good news. So, summary of Romans 1:18 through 3:20. We are in deep trouble. All have sinned. All fallen short. Jew and Gentile alike are under sin. Ah, but Romans 3:21. The next two chapters are about salvation by faith through the blood of Jesus. And to me, Romans 3:21 through 30 is the heart of Romans. And in some ways it's a little bit of exaggeration, but we could even think of it in some ways as the heart of really the New Testament, the heart of the gospel. So aren't you glad you came tonight instead of last Wednesday? It's all depressing stuff, you know? All right, Romans 3:21 through 30. Although, you know, some of us were, yeah, Gabe was here last week too. All right. All right, here we go. But now, apart from the law, so there is a righteousness, but that righteousness is not gained through the law. It's just not. Okay, why not? Because the law said, do these things and you will live. That's Leviticus, I think it's 18 verse 4. Do these things, you'll live. Oh, great, thanks. You know, jump over across the Grand Canyon, you will live. Okay, well, thanks a lot. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. He's going to do this again and again and again, to which the law and the prophets testify. And he says, all like under sin, what's he do? Quote, like 16 different verses, not really, but 5 different verses. All right? What do you say in Romans chapter 1? As the law and the prophets testify. He's going to do this many, many times. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and all fall short of the glory of God. That is the end of the story. All right? And all are justified freely by his grace through redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Where then is boasting? Excluded. Because of what law? The law that requires works? No, because of the law that requires faith. For we maintain that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles too? Yes, of Gentiles too. Since there's only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. Do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. We uphold the law. Jesus said, Romans 5:17, I've come to fulfill the law, not to end it, but to fulfill it. All right, the law and the prophets testify that a different kind of righteousness was coming. If you don't believe that, read Isaiah 53. Or read Daniel chapter 9. Or read Jeremiah 31, 31 through 36. Or read, as we did a couple weeks ago on Sunday, Ezekiel 36, 24 through 37, and many, many more. Saying, you know, a new covenant. I'm going to give a new covenant. A covenant, you know, on your heart and all that sort of stuff. It says, it's a covenant of righteousness. It is by righteousness. Through faith. Righteousness through faith. By the way, there's an interesting thing. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ. But what's interesting is the actual word is through faith of Jesus Christ. All right, but the NIV translated it as in because the NIV translators think that's what he means. So there's two possible interpretations. One possible interpretation is this righteousness is given through the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. In other words, through Jesus Christ having been faithful, we have the opportunity for righteousness. Or the other possibility is this righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ. So the reason is pisto, that Greek word, can mean faith. It can also mean faithfulness. But scholars are nearly unanimous. There's a couple of translations that literally say through the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. And if you ever see that, that's not a bad translation. All right? It's probably not the best interpretation. You know what? They're both true. But really, what's Romans all about? It's all about righteousness through faith in Jesus Christ. And so that being the case, you could go with the other translation. It wouldn't really change the overall message of Romans really at all. So here you go. Romans 3, 22 through 23. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile. What that tells me is big sins, little sins, no difference. bad sinner, you know, not so terribly sinful. It's all the same. Doesn't really matter. We're all in the same spot. Verse 24. So all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely. All right, so we gotta define these really cool terms. Justification. The Greek word is dikios. And the technical meaning of justified is aligned with. So let's, for example, we have the right-hand railroad track, and then the left-hand railroad track is justified. All right? Means in alignment. So if we're justified by Jesus, that means we're aligned with God. Before, we were like this, and through Jesus Christ, we're like that. That's kind of the literal meaning of justified. This word justification is a legal term. Okay? So righteous is not a legal term, but justified is a legal term. It means to be aligned with, or basically to be declared not guilty. So God declares us not guilty. All right? And then he makes us righteous. So justified and righteous are two sides of the same coin. So justified is God says, all right, there you go. End of story. And then he makes us righteous over a period of time. So to be justified means to be made righteous even though you're not. And one way I've heard it, it's pretty easy to remember, to be made just as if I'd never sinned. To be justified means to be made just as if I'd never sinned. Okay? That's what it means. So righteousness and justification are two sides of the same coin. Righteousness has to do with a moral righteousness, and justification has to do with a legal righteousness. So justification has to do with essentially where you stand, and righteousness has to do with how you act. One is a legal term, the other one is a moral term. Okay? So it's, okay, great. Verse 24. We are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. Now this word redemption. Where do we use the word redeemed? In our everyday lives, somebody, put it this way. Somebody give me, don't be religious. Use the word redeemed in a non-religious sentence. Okay, yes, I redeemed the coupons. All right? And another place to use the word redeemed is in a pawn shop. If you know what happens in a pawn shop, that's what redeemed means. It means bought back. All right? To be redeemed means you were sold into slavery, and you were bought back from slavery. That's what Hosea did for Gomer. Right? He went to her pimp and he bought her back. He bought his own wife because she'd sold herself to slavery to that pimp. So that's what redemption is about. Basically, God paid our price. But this has raised centuries and centuries of debate. Because if we've been bought back, we've been bought back from whom? Yeah, so that in the Middle Ages, that was the most common theory of redemption, is that we were bought back from Satan. Now, almost nobody today will agree that that is the correct understanding. All right, but it was the most common understanding from about 300 AD right up until the time of the Reformation. That basically Satan owned us and God bought us back from Satan. And you can defend that theory. In fact, you could use the whole situation in Egypt with Pharaoh to defend that theory. In fact, there are a number of theories of atonement. All right, let me see. There's the ransom theory. All right, these are different theories of atonement that theologians have used over the years. The ransom theory that Satan owned our souls and he was paid a ransom to buy us back for God. This was the favorite theory of Gregory the Great, which is in the 6th century AD. And from the time of Gregory on, for almost 1,000 years, it was the primary theory used, certainly in the Western Church, not in the Eastern Church. The Eastern Church, they're more the deification model of redemption. God became man so that man could become like God. And the fact is, the Eastern Church, which would be represented, I wish Alex was here, because I'm going to say good things about our friend Alex, who comes almost every Wednesday. He is Orthodox. So the Orthodox tradition is this idea. The Orthodox don't look so much about at justification, but at sanctification. They think of redemption as a process of sanctification. I'm not saying right or wrong. I think there's some truth in both of those. So the deification, God became man so that man could become like God. This was the theory of the Cappadocian fathers, like Basil and all these other guys. And this is the 5th century in Turkey and the Eastern Church, basically. Now, the theory that was proposed by Anselm in the 11th century, which was the first attempt to kind of move away from the ransom theory, is this. The death of Jesus satisfied the penalty owed to God for our sin and releases us from the penalty. So basically, infinite sin required infinite penalty, and the infinite penalty was paid by Jesus. So Anselm in the 11th century. All right, and so I'm just telling you some of the theories. Now, the most common theory of redemption in the evangelical Protestant world today is called PSA, penal substitutionary atonement. Penal, what's that mean?
Penalty.
Punishment. So basically, the most common sort of theory of redemption kind of in the evangelical world is that basically God's wrath was going to come on us, but instead God poured his wrath on Jesus, and because he poured his wrath on Jesus and Jesus took that wrath, therefore we don't have to take that wrath. All right, and there are scriptures that supports that, but there's, you know, I would say this, the idea of redemption in the Bible is a pretty broad idea. And hanging on to just one theory of redemption probably is a little bit limiting. And because honestly, the Bible describes redemption more through metaphors than through sort of cold, hard statements. All right, I'm probably talking about that a little bit too much. I'm getting a little bit too into all this theoretical stuff here. Any questions? The penal substitutionary atonement is sort of a stepchild of the third one. But the third one doesn't mention wrath, that penal aspect. Okay? But let's read the rest of this verse and you can see why people landed there. Let's finish reading this verse. I'm really parking here because this is really important stuff. To understanding what Christianity is all about, at least in a theological sense, Romans 3 is really, really important. So forgive me for kind of getting a little bit more in depth here than I normally might. All right, so here you go. Let me back up to verse 24 and start over now that we've developed these big fancy words. And all are justified, put into alignment, just as if I'd never sinned, a legal term, freely by his grace through the redemption, right? The buying back from a position of being enslaved that came by Jesus Christ. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. A sacrifice of atonement. All right? And that reminds us of the mercy seat. The word atonement in Greek is directly tied to the word that's used for the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. Now, if you don't know a lot about Christianity, I'm probably talking about stuff maybe you don't know a whole lot about, all right? But when the high priest went behind the curtain on the Day of Atonement, he sprinkled the blood on the mercy seat. And that was the place where the blood was put so that the people would be freed from the from their sins. All right? So is that about wrath? Is that about ransom? You know, what is that about? All right? And people spend a lot of time on talking about this. But I would say this. The cross was the propitiation for our sins. That's another word that's used. See that? Sacrifice of atonement? Another word is propitiation. Oh, my goodness. That propitiation has this negative implication of wrath. And so the translators of the New International Version, they don't like that sort of that wrath aspect. But if you look at the Greek, atonement is a softer word. Propitiation is a harder word. To propitiate would be like somebody's really mad at you and you say, here, let me give you, your kid's mad, you give him a lollipop, you propitiated your kid, I don't know. Or you know, I don't know. So right now Fox News is going to propitiate by giving him 780 million, you know, anyway, whatever. Okay, good. So, just so you know, just a warning, the word that's translated a sacrifice of atonement, that's a tough word to translate. So there's the softer atonement, which means at one meant, a sacrifice that makes us one with God. Or is it a sacrifice of propitiation to satisfy God's wrath? All right? I really think it's both. I listen to people debating this stuff. I go, well, you guys are wasting your time debating this. What's the cross about? Is it about punishment? It's about punishment, but it's also about love. And it's also about God triumphing over the world. It's about a lot of things. The message of the cross has a lot to tell us. All right. I would say this. Penal substitutionary atonement, which is probably what you learned if you went to church and listened, is not the whole story, okay? It's part of the story. All right, let's go on. We got to finish this chapter. And I got to do at least a little bit of Romans 4. Oh, my goodness, I'm so much trouble. Okay, good. Here we go. Oh, but this next part is so important. All right, so God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith, right? So how do we acquire this saving thing, this redemption? How do we acquire it? Through faith, right? That's the whole point. Good. Now, it says to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, he left the sins committed before and unpunished. And before what? Before the death of Christ. Before the death of Christ, this whole thing didn't apply to anybody, right? And so God was holding back his judgment. He was holding back his justice. I mean, God is a just God, and sin requires retribution, and God wasn't giving the he was arguably not being just. So what Paul's doing is he's defending the justice of God. That's what he's doing here. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his performance, he'd left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. That would be a bad thing if justice is all it's about. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus Christ. So the cross both demonstrated God's justice, his righteousness, but it also created righteousness for us. So at the cross, God's righteousness was established because the sins that had been committed beforehand were now being atoned for, at least potentially. But also, so he was becoming righteous himself, and he was also making us righteous. Sounds like an interesting argument. Paul does pretty complex arguments here. That's what's going on. So at the cross, God both was proved just and he justified us. just as if we'd never sinned. So basically, the justice that was going to come on us instead came on Christ. Okay, I should go to the next slide because it says it right there. All right, atonement. Oh, yes, I should have got atonement, a reference to the mercy seat in the tabernacle, a removal of the consequences of sin, a restoring of a relationship that was broken at one-ment. That's that word, hilasterion. That's that one that could also be translated as propitiation. Okay? Faith. Faith has a wide range of meaning. But the meaning of faith in Romans 3 is really, really important. Well, guess what? In Romans 4, he will define the word faith. Right now he's just using the word faith, but he's not really defining it. Romans 4 is where he's going to define what that faith is. That's why we better get to Romans 4 really soon. God allowed Jesus to die instead of us to demonstrate his justice. What does justice demand? The wages of sin are death. Ezekiel 18:4, the soul who sins will die. That's God's justice. The cross demonstrated God's justice. And there's a sense in which it doesn't seem just. How can not punishing us demonstrate God's justice? Well, here's the deal. At the cross, God's justice and his love met. God's justice goes this way. God's love goes this way. God's justice says, you're going to hell. God's love says, I want to have a relationship with you for eternity. God's justice and his love met at the cross. Okay? That's what happened. So the cross is the propitiation for our sins. The cross is the ultimate demonstration of God's love. The cross was the means by which Jesus overcame and destroyed the powers of this world. What does justice demand? Death. What does God give us instead? Righteousness. That's the mystery of the gospel. That's the beauty of the gospel. It's not logical. It doesn't make sense. It's about God's love. God's justice and justification were at odds. But God loved us so much, he gave his one and only son. So let's finish this chapter. I'm just barely saying anything. I'm going to get into chapter 4. So where is boasting? Did you get up on the cross? Where's boasting? That's crazy stuff, right? We maintain that a person is justified by faith. Now, where is the boasting? Who's he going after here? The Jews. Right? Man, we're better than those guys. No. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and are freely justified through faith in his blood. Okay? For we maintain that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of Jews only? No, he's the God of both, right? Since there's only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith, the uncircumcised by the same faith. Do we nullify the law? No. We uphold it. That's what he's demonstrated. Because remember what he said earlier in this chapter, right? As the scriptures say in the law and the prophets. Okay. Romans 4. Oh, man. I love Romans 3, but I love Romans 4 even better. I'm not going to get very far. Oh, I wanted to finish it, but I'm not going to be able to. Romans 4, 1 through 3. What shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, discovered in this matter? So in Romans 4, we're going to establish what we're talking about. We're talking about faith, right? So in Romans 4, we're going to find out what we mean by faith. Okay, got it? And why faith? What shall we say then that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, discovered this matter? If in fact Abraham was justified by works, he had something to boast about. But what did he say in verse 27 of chapter 3? Where's the boasting? None. All right? But not before God. All right, so before God, how much do your works count? Is God impressed by all the work that you do? Well, if you're his son, he's impressed, but if you're, or his daughter, excuse me, but if you're outside of Christ, he's not particularly impressed. How much credit, in quotes, does our work earn before God? Zero. Nothing to boast about. What did God owe Abraham? Because of his awesomeness. Nothing. Nothing at all. All right, let me continue reading. All right, now, to the one who works, wages are not credited as a gift, but as an obligation. However, to the one who does not work, but trusts God, who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. David said the same thing when he speaks of the blessedness of the one to whom God credits righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord will never count against them. So, faith. The word faith in Greek is pistos. Pistos has a number of different meanings in different contexts. Sometimes pistos means belief. All right? So, in, for example, in John 8:31, to the Jews who believed in him, that word is pistos. Okay? So, faith sometimes means belief. All right? In fact, in Hebrews 11:1-6, basically it defines faith as belief. Right? Belief that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Other times it means trust, like in Romans 4. All right? So, the definition of faith that's relevant to salvation is the best translation of the word pistos, all right, of faith, that the saving faith is a trusting faith. It's not a believing faith. Although, again, the word could be translated as belief. You know, God so loved the world that whoever believed in him, we don't say whoever faithed in him. We don't say that. All right, by the way, the word pistos also means obedience. In fact, in Hebrews 3:18-19, it says, who was not able to enter his rest? Those who did not have faith. And then it says, who wasn't able to enter his rest? Those who disobeyed. Those who didn't have faith and those who disobeyed are equal. So faith is obedience. Faith is belief, mental assent. Faith is trust. And by the way, another meaning of the word faith is like the faith once and for all delivered to the saints, a system of beliefs. In fact, if you read medieval writings, when they talk about the faith, they're always talking about a set of beliefs and practices, like the Catholic faith, right? Or the whatever. Got it? Those are different meanings. All right, but in Romans 4:4-8, he says, work means obligation. And what do we gain by our works? Not a whole lot. What do we gain by trusting God? Righteousness. All right? So he's equating faith with trust here. Okay? Romans 4:9-12. Is this blessedness only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? Now, we all already know the answer to that, right? Is it only for the circumcised? No, it's not. It's not. How many times has he said this already? Oh, my goodness gracious. Those Jews are kind of squirming a little bit, man. Paul, come on, just stop, you know, come on, we get it. No, you don't get it. So I'm going to keep saying it, All right? We have been saying that Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness. Right? Oh, yes. Under what circumstances was it credited? Was it after he was circumcised or before? It was not after, but before. And he received circumcision as a sign, a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. So then he is the father of all who believe but have not been circumcised in order that righteousness might be credited to them. And he is also the father of the circumcised who not only have been circumcised but who also follow in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. He's making a big deal about the whole timing here. But really what it's referring to is Genesis 15. If you read Genesis 15, it says, Abraham believed God. About what? He said, you're going to have a son. And through that son, all nations will be blessed. I'll give you this land. Abraham received the promises in Genesis 12, in Genesis 15, in Genesis 18, and in Genesis 22, four different times. But the relevant one is Genesis 15, because it says right there, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Now, when was the covenant of circumcision put into effect? No, definitely not. Mm-mm. No. Genesis 17. Two chapters later. By the way, 14 years later. All right? Now, for us as Christians, like, whatever, who cares? What's the order matter? But Paul's making a really crucial argument. The bottom line is, Abraham was not a Jew when he was justified by faith. That's what he's saying. Abraham did not become a Jew until he was circumcised. All right? So, I mean, to us who aren't Jewish, it's like, you know, why do we care? But he is making a point, especially to the Jews, but it's a point for everybody. So, Genesis 15, verse 1 through 5, Abraham believed God. It was credited to him as righteousness, which he quoted there in Romans 1. He quotes it several times. He quotes it right here in chapter 4 again, right? And then two chapters later, Genesis 17, Abraham receives the covenant of circumcision. So he was declared righteous by faith before he was even a Jew. So he's saying that proves that the righteousness of faith is independent of circumcision. Therefore, it's independent of being Jewish. All right? Like I said, two major themes in Romans, but the one that's in every chapter is this whole Jew Gentile thing. Okay, got it? All right. Great. I'm going to finish out this chapter. I won't go into detail, but I want to... All right, so what's the big deal here for Paul? Abraham's faith, and therefore his righteousness, preceded his circumcision. Who will be made righteous? Those who walk in the footsteps of Abraham. What does it mean to trust? What does it mean to walk in the footsteps of Abraham? It says, Abraham believed, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Right? What did he believe? He believed the promises. That's it. Now, like I said, faith has many meanings. In the New Testament, that word pistos. But saving faith is essentially a belief in the promises of God. And I'm telling you, you don't believe in the promises of God unless you act on that belief in the promise of God. All right? So, this is not faith apart from works. We are not saved by faith alone. We're saved by faith which is in conjunction with the works that come from that faith. That's that whole argument that I won't get into right now. All right, let me read on. All right. Oh, yeah. Oh, here we go. Next slide. Where will following Abraham take you? Number one, it'll take you out of Ur. You follow the footsteps of Abraham, it'll take you out of Ur, which is the place where you leave all your worldly things behind and walk by faith for the rest of your life. That's when you put your hand to the plow and you say, I'm not going to look back, right? That's when you become a disciple. But if you're going to follow Abraham, you're going to follow him to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah, Genesis 22. That's where Abraham offered his one and only son. So if you're going to follow in the footsteps of Abraham, you're going to leave your life behind. You're going to leave all those things behind, and you're going to walk by faith. But you're also going to go to Mount Moriah, which is where you lay on the altar, even the blessings that God has given you. All right, so which do you live by? It's one of these rhetorical questions for you to go home and think about. Do you live by law or do you live by faith? Do you live by rules or do you live by faith? Okay? But in verse 16 it says, therefore, did I skip verse 13? I think I did. All right. It was not through the law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir. It was not through the law, because when was the law given? 430 years later. Never mind circumcision, which was given 14 years later. It was definitely not through the law that he was declared righteous, because the law came 430 years later, as Paul points out in Galatians chapter 3, verse, I think it's 7. All right, here we go. That he would be heir of the world, but through the righteousness that comes by faith. For if those who depend on the law are heirs, faith means nothing. And the promise is worthless, because the law brings wrath. And where there is no law, there is no transgression. Are you saying that there was no sin outside of the law? Not exactly. Because it turns out there's two words for sin. All right, and that's in Hebrews chapter 2. But this sin, parabasis, means transgression of a particular law. In other words, this word, what was I just reading? Verse blah, 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 blah. Verse what? 14. Verse 14. For those who depend on the law are heirs, faith means nothing. Verse 15. Because the law brings wrath, and where there is no law, there is no transgression. And that is literally true. So this word transgression is not necessarily sin. It means there's no rule breaking. Okay? Where there's no law, there's no rule breaking. All right. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who have the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. He is the forerunner. He is the type. We are the antitype. He is the prefigure. All right? We are the ones who are prefigured. He represents that salvation is by grace through faith. As it is written, I've made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believes, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. All right, this is great stuff. Who are Abraham's offspring? The Jews are saying we are. And he's saying those who walk in the footsteps of Abraham. All right, now, it's almost quarter hour, so I have to stop. But Romans, thank you, Jen. Romans 4:18 through 23. All right, this kind of defines faith. We'll do this in 2 weeks. So faith is belief against hope. Faith is belief in things that are impossible. Abraham's body was as good as dead, and yet he believed. This, he became the father of many nations. He did not waver in unbelief, and he was fully persuaded. Abraham was fully persuaded that God was able to do what he said he would do. All right, I wanted to get in groups and... Should we? No, Jan says we don't have time for that. Aww. Aww. I talk too long. I'm sorry. All right, announcements. Let me see. This Friday at 6:30, we're going to play Capture the Flag at Applegate Park. And if you want to go and don't have a ride, give me a call, give Zane a call, Monica a call. We get rides. We give rides. No problem. At 6:30, I don't know if you've ever done Capture the Flag. It's a lot of fun. It's fun. And so we're starting at 6:30, so we can do the first half while it's light, and then the second half after it gets dark. They'll both be fun. Yeah. All right. Sunday we have worship at my place. This is a non-denominational club. You're invited to our church, but this is an activity of the club. Friday night, activity of the club. Camping trip next Friday, Saturday, Sunday, activity of the club. You're totally invited to church on Sunday, but that is not an official club activity, okay? But you're invited. All right. Yes. So Sunday, 1195 Pinnacle Drive, and then next Friday, we have our camp camping trip. How many are planning on going to the camping trip? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, great. All right. It's only $50. You can still register. What I'll do is I'll put up on the screen when I stop talking. You're probably thinking I'm never going to stop talking. When I stop talking, I'll put up the registration on the screen. If you're interested in going, it's at Bass Lake. I've been there. It's an absolutely gorgeous place. It's going to be the best fun ever. Only $50. If you don't have $50, let us know. We'll figure out a way to get you there. All right? So let's end in a prayer. Yes? Yeah. Well, that's right. I invited you for a specific reason to invite people to your activity, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, you waited this whole time for that, too. You're so polite. You're so polite. Yes, I specifically asked her to tell you about another activity.
A volunteer opportunity this summer. So I'm a volunteer at a non-denominational volunteer on camp called Camp St. Andrews. And basically our entire purpose of our summer camp is to get kids out in nature to become more with themselves, with others, and with God. Mm-hmm. And so basically a couple ways to do this is our location. We're located up in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. We don't have any cell service up there. It's a one-week-long overnight camp. So you really get to be with nature. You get to kind of quiet yourself, unplug from the stress of day-to-day life. We go on different nature walks. So we have a nightly campfire where you can, you know, see the Milky Way galaxy. Really great up in nature. And then how we get people to be closer to God. We have daily chapel services with the Eucharist service at the end of the week. And then we have our scarf ceremony, which we derive from, I don't know if any of you guys know, YMCA, but they're Rider Society. So basically, the scarf is optional, but it's you choosing to take up a challenge to bring from camp into the outside world. And that could be becoming closer with yourself, others, and God, dedication of your time, talent, and will, dedication to community service, dedication to high and noble living. You take on that challenge. It's an internal challenge. It's between you, between God, to just become a better person. And what we really need is counselors. So basically, you would be working that week at camp, helping other kids do different activities, bringing them, making friends, just making sure that everyone's having a good time. And it's a really great chance to gain leadership experience, community service, if you're in need of any community service, which looks honestly really great on a resume. I just got a scholarship for my service at this camp. So, you know, if you guys need any of that, it's really fun. But it's also just a great time to kind of get away from everyday life, kind of find yourself, relax, and just, yeah, kind of give back to, kids, give back to the community, and just be one in nature. So, yeah.
Do you have, contact information?
I have some flyers if anyone's interested.
Why don't you put it up on the...
The dates is going to be the last full week of July. So I believe it is July 23rd to July 30th.
Okay.
So I'm going
to go. And where is it located physically?
It is located in Dardanelle, California. If any of you guys know Kennedy Meadows or Pinecrest, it's in between those. If you know Pinecrest, is about 30 minutes up. If you know the city Strawberry, it's around that. Basically, you get onto either 120, I think, over here in Mercedes Junction 56, and you just go straight.
Okay.
You just go all the way up.
Nice.
That's the email.
Yeah. Cool. And then, if anyone's interested, or if anyone knows someone who might be interested, I have some flyers if anybody wants.
I'll take one.
Yeah, and could you send me information and I'll put it out through our, we'll put it on our Instagram.
I'm not quite sure what the cat
was. I got it.
Okay. So thank you guys so
much. And your name?
You.
Oh, my name is Delaney.
Delaney.
Delaney News. So D-E-L-A-N-E-Y-N-U-N-E-S.
Great. July. Like 23rd through 30th, I see what you mean. Great. And who goes to this camp? It's high school kids or?
It's kids of all ages. So our campers are ages 8 to 13. Our leaders in training are 14, 15, and then counselors in training 16, 17, and the staff is 18 and 19.
Okay, good.
And we have to drive ourselves up there?
Yeah, you would have to drive yourselves up there, and we can help arrange transportation to
close there.
Did anyone else on the flyer? Are you interested?
So you're interested in the camping trip next weekend? I got to get rid of that so you can see how to register. But oh, they did good. Here's a list of what to bring.
There we go. That's what you want, your dog.
Oh, there's my dog. Oh, there's my doggy. Oh, Samson. Oh, the best doggy ever. Here's the schedule.
Oh, that's good.
You see that dinner's at 6, so you guys might want to leave at 4:30. Yeah. Okay. Monica, your group's going to get there later than this, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then she asked if the boys could set up their tents.
All right, yeah. The boys?
The boys.
So we'll probably have at least 3 cars going up there, maybe 4. And so let's assume that we're going to be leaving at 4:30. Where do you want to meet for going there? Everybody knows my house, so they can meet at my house.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to go to
It's sort of the wrong direction, but all right. So let's plan on meeting at our place at 4:30 on Friday, except those who are going with Monica. How do I make this thing go away? No, it's not no. If he was 27 or 28 maybe, but you could go as a camp counselor. There we go. It worked. So it ends 12 o'clock on Sunday. Interesting. See you later, Emily.
Who?
QR code. John, can you send it that image?
No, QR code.
Okay.
Can you go back?
Yes, I could. Oops. There it is. QR code. So do you have any students who've said yes for your thing yet?
Yeah, I had one.
One? Oh.
One, you too.
Are you like a director or assistant director or something like that?
I'm program director this year.
Nice.
So I've been going there for a while, and I've been staff for the last few years.
Cool.
I'm program director this year, so it's, yeah.
Great.
Did it work? It's really fun.
No?
I like it.
Maybe that one.
By the way, if you'd said something, I would have let you... say something earlier.
No, you were talking.
All right, all right.
Why?
Yeah. Okay, good.
What was I going to do, interrupt your talk on Romans?
No, but, you know, like before I started or something like that.
No.
Yeah, all right, that's fine. Anyway, hopefully, you know, hey, it's good to hear more about Romans, right?
Oh, you want me to email you the information?
Right, and we'll put it up at our Instagram.
Okay, which email?
All right. It doesn't work. There you go. There's my website. That's my website. That is my correct email address. That's not my correct phone number. But. Okay. Yes. How do I make that thing? How do I make that done? Here we go. Oops. There you go. Up. Stop that. There you go.
There's the website.
Monica, bye. See you Friday, 6:30. It's not flag football. It's just one flag. This is not flag football. You having trouble getting to that thing?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to get to the... I got to run because I'm trying to get to the pad before it closes.
Okay.
Yeah, I get that too. So I guess I have to register via the link.
All right. Sorry about that.
Yeah. All right.
Set... If you contact me, I'll get you to the right place. Because I know more than one person who definitely went there and they registered.
Okay.
Maybe there. Try this computer. Maybe through right here. Try this one. Right here. Try his link right there and see if it works.
I'll
scan it.
I'm kind of busy.
He has to go.
Yeah.
See you later.
Yeah. If I can't like scan through, get through or some for some reason. Should I just text you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
You have my phone number?
Yeah, I have your phone number.
Okay, great.
Oh, yeah, it works. Yeah. Okay. I just put my phone up to it, and it totally works.
Yeah, but if you, like, click on the link, like, open it, it says that it's, like, paused exactly.
You have to pay $35 or something.
And I ain't paying.
That's Yeah, no, we're not paying $35. No, we're not going to do that. I don't know why that happened. I'll call my friend and ask him what happened, because he'll probably be able to fix it.
Okay. Well, I'll... try to sign up as soon as can.
Great.
All right.
See you around. Yep.
Whoopsie. Didn't say anything about $35.
I'm not sure where that's coming. If you get a credit, you're
wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, if it doesn't work, let us know. We'll make sure it works somehow.
Yeah.
Okay?
Bye, guys. Thank you.
Yep.
Good night. Do you want to be up tomorrow?
Yeah, what time?
What's the best time?